This is Closer Look. Great to have you along with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Rose Scott. Perhaps you've heard of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and most recently because of the death of civil rights leader Julian Bond, one of the center's co-founders and its first president. The center's been around since 1971.
And among other things, the center monitors and files lawsuits against hate groups. It also does legal work on equality issues for minorities, women, the disabled, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Leisha Brooks is outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. She also directs the Civil Rights Memorial Center in Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Rose, for having me.
First of all, how important was Julian Bond in the formation of the center at its very beginning?
Julian agreeing to serve as the first president of the Southern Poverty Law Center in 1971 was everything. Morris Dease and Joe Levin, who grew up in Montgomery, Alabama, two white men who grew up during the Jim Crow era, were so moved by what happened, how the South was being transformed as a result of the civil rights movement. They thought they could kind of continue the work that was done before them by starting a civil rights litigation firm. They went to Julian and asked him if he would help with that. And because Morris and Joe were not directly involved in the civil rights movement, it was critical that it's critical to our success that we had someone like Julian Bond, who, as you know, has been involved in with the civil rights movement since he was 20 years old. So he helped us define our strategy, our litigation strategy, our programmatic strategy from the time we began in 1971 to his untimely death. He's just been such a huge part of the work of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Which begs the question, I mean, certainly it's one thing to lend one's name to it, and to perhaps help in overall planning and strategy, but was he actively involved in the day-to-day work over the years, especially since he was a state lawmaker, he ran for Congress, he was the chairman of the NAACP nationally. So how intimately was he involved in the Southern Poverty Law Center over the years?
Well, certainly Julian was a very busy man, and he gave us as much time as he possibly could. He was always available to us by phone, for instance. In the early days, though, he was seated in the legislature in 1966. So when we started in 1971, he was a few years in, and so kind of, you know, was able to better manage those two positions. And of course, the legislature is not in session all the time. So he was very, very critical. And Atlanta is not far from Montgomery. And when the Southern Poverty Law Center, as I said, began in 1971, we were very small. It was just Joe and Morris, and we had just had a few lawsuits. We were primarily suing the state, and he helped us identify which cases we should pursue. As the center grew, Julian's role grew, and he remained not only the first president, but served on the board, and he's a board emeritus member to this day. And his participation in the board, as is true of all our board members, are very critical to our strategic planning, both long-term and short-term. I should add that Julian also, you know, he narrated Eyes on the Prize. Mm-hmm. The Southern Poverty Law Center, through our Teaching Tolerance program, produces documentary films in Julian narrated our Time for Justice documentary about the civil rights movement, which won an Academy Award. He also narrated No Place for Hate. I'm sorry, I've gotten that word wrong. And most recently, we produced a documentary film on the Selma to Montgomery voting rights campaign called Selma, The Bridge to the Ballot. He was our historical consultant. We relied on him heavily to guarantee some historical accuracy around that film. He anything we needed, he was there for us, and as I say, continued to help lead and drive us. You mentioned that the Southern Poverty Law Center is engaged in LGBT rights, which is correct, one of the many practice groups that we're involved in. And Julian, as he was a moving force in moving the NAACP to support LGBT rights and more specifically marriage equality, he did, by him doing that, he helped us. So what Julian was able to do across the country, and he had a very large bully pulpit, helped move the agenda of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Things that he was interested in are things that the Southern Poverty Law Center is certainly interested in. As we know, you know, he's a big supporter of LGBT rights, mm-hmm. also women's reproductive health rights, environmental issues, but more to the center's issues around tracking and monitoring hate groups. Of course, Julian wants to be known as a race man, someone in the fine tradition of black social justice, and so he never let us forget that our work should be centered there as well. So our work in mass incarceration is a reflection of, you know, what Julian taught us. Julian really taught the center, or helped us over these years, recognize what are the critical issues that are facing us as a society, and to do all we can to kind of, you know, make things better. That's what Julian did, not only for us, but really for the country.
We're speaking with Leisha Brooks, who is the Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. She also directs the Civil Rights Memorial Center in Montgomery. And we're talking about the legacy of Julian Bond. And Ms. Brooks, you know, we know that part of the core of the mission, obviously, of the center is to also educate and bring awareness about white supremacist groups and their membership. Mm-hmm. And it's dropped over the years, although they've hardly disappeared. But do you attribute that in part to the center's work, or just sort of the political and social momentum of the nation in terms of, with so much going on, no one wants their group to be labeled a hate group? But you all focus on that. So what are we seeing, though? What progress are we seeing in what you all have been able to do as it relates to those type of groups?
Well, we started tracking hate groups, hate and extremist groups, in the year 2000, more deliberately, intentionally rather. Of course, our early involvement in cases against groups like the United Klans of America date back to 1981. But we started tracking and monitoring and identifying groups as hate groups as a way to disrupt them, dismantle them, bankrupt them. You know, part of our litigation work is to bring civil suits against hate and extremist groups, and we've been very successful in that manner. However, one way to augment that work to kind of destroy hate groups is to monitor them, track them, and publicize information across the United States about who we identify as an active hate group in the United States. Now, that we've seen a steady increase since the year 2000. It's gone down over the last couple of years, which, you know, is heartening, but there's still far too many active hate groups in the United States. We saw a huge increase, say, when President Obama was elected, and again at his reelection, and now it's gone down a little bit as people accept that, you know, he's gotten a second term. I should also note that there has been a distinct spike in the number of hate groups with President Obama, but there has always been historically an increase in hate groups when there is a Democrat in the White House.
When we look at the massacre at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, and the young man that authorities
Dylan
say,
Roof.
Yeah, Dylan Roof, are you also concerned too, considering his age? Is that also a concern for you, that perhaps you're starting to see sort of younger people being influenced by some of these hate groups?
Well, that's interesting, Rose. The truth is that, well, that's one of the reasons why we have our Teaching Tolerance program. It began in 1991, and Moore saw it as a way to reach young people before they became susceptible to messages of hate. However, if you look at the Dylan Roof case and juxtapose that to our first case against the United Klans of America, the two young men that killed Michael Donald in 1981 in Mobile, Alabama, and then lynched him from a tree, were also about the same age. What we find is true, and consistently true, is that the leaders of these organizations tend to be older, but their recruits tend to be younger. And so you have this whole group of disenfranchised relatively poor, relatively undereducated white men who are susceptible to these messages of hate from these older guys. Now, what we're finding, though, is that as it becomes increasingly less popular to join groups like United Clans of America or kind of a group that meets and, you know, has a regular kind of meeting place, we're finding this phenomenon we're calling lone wolves. And that's what happened with Mr. Wolf, Roof, is that anyone can go online and get this information from these hate groups and actually kind of get their marching orders just online instead of meeting. And that's exactly what happened in this case. We're of course very, you know, saddened by the tragedy and the massacre that happened in Charleston. And at the same time, we have long identified the Conservative Citizen Council as a hate group, right? And have been trying to sound the alarm about the rhetoric, the hate rhetoric that you find on these groups' websites, and how dangerous it in fact really is. And so we see with what happened in Charleston that it's quite true.
Real quickly, and I apologize, we're short of time here. The center also has extremist watch lists and so forth, correct?
Yes, we have a map that you can go to our website and see it, where we identify all the active hate groups. We also have a listing of what we call extreme anti-government groups.
Yeah, and the process, and you've encountered a lot of criticism for on behalf of people who, at least according to the critics, have said they don't belong on that.
Okay.
On those lists. I mean,
sure. Say like the American Family Association,
sure.
And Tony Perkins.
Dr. Ben Carson, even.
Oh, yeah.
You had to, I think, apologize for putting him on an extremist watch list earlier this year.
Yeah.
So
that's true. That was unfortunate. And
so
the list identifying individuals is vastly different than the map that we use to identify active hate groups. It was a mistake to identify Dr. Carson on the watch list that you mentioned, and we have apologized for that.
Yeah, and did Julian Bond, to come back to him, did he feel that, hey, maybe this process has become too ideological or maybe not careful enough?
Julian Bond?
Yes.
No. Julian Bond, the thing that, and I don't know, we didn't have this conversation, but I'm just extrapolating based on my experience with Julian, is that Julian is liable to kind of just speak truth and speak the truth as he sees it. Now, many people identify what Dr. Carson has said as being troublesome, and in fact may be dangerous. I don't know. And I have no idea what Julian Bond would say about that. And he did. He was not involved in the defining who was on the list or coming up with the list. He didn't. You know, he wasn't involved in the weeds in that way. So I don't want Julian and Julian's reputation or legacy to be in any way attached to it, because he had nothing to do with it. I don't even know why we're having the conversation about Julian and this list.
Ms. Brooks, as we talk about Julian Bond's legacy and what it looks like, everyone has had their own sort of defining moment regarding Julian Bond's legacy. What is it for you?
For me, as the director of the Civil Rights Memorial Center, Julian really helped me to understand that the civil rights movement was really about the power of the people. He saw it as a people's movement. And he really shied away from identifying and giving credit to a few leaders, and really helped me to see that the civil rights movement was successful because of the cumulative efforts of regular, everyday people, of which he would count himself as one. He never separated himself from the people in that way, and was on the front line from the beginning of the founding of SNCC to the day he died. He was all about pushing for social justice in every arena.
Leisha Brooks is the Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center and Director of the Civil Rights Memorial Center in Montgomery. Thank you for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks, Dennis. Bye-bye.